Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, listeners, Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars.
We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
Jesus Shakes the Goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman Twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us your reviews, please. Friends.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. We're also excited to announce you can now listen to us on Broadway Radio.
Ooh. Today's guest is a legend amongst musical theater fans. While audiences across America might remember her many appearances on The Merv Griffin Show, our listeners will probably know her for having one of the most amazing voices from the golden age of the American musical. She was destined to become the next Ethel Merman. Hyperbolic? Not really, because that's a direct quote from Ethel Merman herself.
I didn't know that. Her incredible voice was heard in such not-so-incredible musicals as I Had a Ball, I'm Solomon, A Joyful Noise, The Selling of the President. I know, you've probably not heard of some of those, but they were great shows in their own right. And what many musical theater fans consider to be an essential cult musical. That's right, The Grass Harp.
She is an Emmy Award-winning actress, cabaret artist, and teacher, plus the undisputed queen of the flops. Joining us via telephone from Los Angeles, direct from the Baby Love Miracle Show, here is the wonderful Karen Morrow. How long have you been in Los Angeles?
Oh, gosh, this is something I keep asking myself. I've been here since 1969. Isn't that, oh, God, doesn't that sound like it's, ancient, 69. Wow. So that must be, how many years is that? Almost, I mean, that's 50 years. Yeah, at least 50-some years, 56. Oh, my God. I never figured it out till now. Do I mean 69? Yeah. Yeah, I got into I got my equity card in 1960, and I was in New York for 9 years, and then came out here, and that's it, honey. Oh, I'm feeling so old at this moment. Anyway,
what do you love? I was gonna say, what do you love about LA so much?
What do I like about it? The weather. I mean, purely simply the weather. I do. It's my home now. Although I still don't think of myself as a Californian. Oddly enough, I think of myself as an Iowan, because I was raised in Iowa, and that's at the foundation of everything I am is Iowa. But I just love the weather out here. I love the fact that I can get in the car and go to the mountains or go to the ocean, or I can go to the desert, and it's just easier. I found New York to be so difficult, even though it isn't. I mean, you take a subway and you can get anywhere. It's great. It's so compact and everything. But I'm not a city person. I'm not a city person at all yet. I mean, the Iowa route. Or there, I want suburbia or something that looks like suburbia.
Karen, I have to ask you, how did you fall in love with musical theater? How did you get started?
Well, let me see. I didn't really. I just was surrounded by music. My parents were both singers. They were classical singers, so we had a lot of classical music. But I of course loved television. I loved all the variety shows on television. So that was who I wish I could become, you know, was somebody on television. Mitzi Gaynor. I thought she was just so cute. She wore great costumes and she wasn't a great singer or anything, but she could dance and be pretty. That was the thing. And who else? Gosh. Isn't this awful? Joe Stafford. Of course, she wasn't on television, but I listened to a lot of records, so it was Joe Stafford, and it was the Four Freshmen, and it was Eddie Fisher. Oh, my God, I thought his voice was sensational. And Gordon McRae, and that was about it. And then when I went to college in Dubuque, Iowa, my second roommate would play me albums from like Broadway albums and anthologies. Like she had the Four Freshmen. Was it the Four Freshmen? It was Four Something Else singing stuff from Happy Fella, with the Standing on the Corner. It would be a real high tenor in the quartet, and I thought that was all kind of swell. I didn't know what kind of voice I had. I just sang. Then I heard a recording of Susan Johnson doing Most Happy Fellow when I was a senior, I think, in college, and then doing the musicals over at the boys' school, and I just fell madly in love with it because it suited my personality and my sound.
Was Brigadoon your first musical there?
Yeah, I did Brigadoon.
Wow.
And I was, of course, Meg Brookie. And and I got an LP of Susan Johnson doing the same song,
mm-hmm.
and I just went, oh my God, that's what I can do. Oh my God, I could use my voice. Oh my God.
What did you love about Susan Johnson so much? Why did she stick out to you?
Oh well, that sound was so. It was not just belting, not. You know, like today's belting, it has no bottom to it. It has no roundness. It's just sharp focus straight ahead. And it sounded, it was a big sound, but it wasn't operatic. It was clear and big and just clear and big, which I thought I had this big voice too. And it didn't, but my voice didn't sound like anybody else's, but it sounded like hers. And so I just identified with it. I didn't know what she looked like or anything. In fact, I didn't even meet her until we did Follies together out here maybe about 15 years ago, something like that.
Well, that must have been really cool.
the boy dancers, of course, they knew we were going to meet. So they all came into the room to watch us meet each other.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It was so sweet, but I burst into tears. And I thought for a whole week, all I did was cry every time I heard her or saw her. And she gave me, on opening night, when she knew I was such a devoted fan, so of course she, you know, cottoned up to me right away. But she gave me a present that Frank Lesser gave her on opening night of Happy Fella. It was an amethyst tie pin. You know how Tony sings that to Rosabella? He leaves her a tie pin in the restaurant. That's the only tip he gives her.
Yes, that's
well,
right.
Well, Frank gave out a bunch of them or something for opening night, and so I have her amethyst tie pin.
What a treasure.
Very big treasure. And I had all my jewelry stolen, And the two things that they dropped was that and my mother's wedding ring. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for that. Everything else was not insignificant. There were some sentimental things, but those two, wow. So I remember her fondly.
What got you from the Midwest to New York City?
Let me see. College in Dubuque. When I graduated from college, my best friend, who went to a different college, we always thought we would do something together. We were going to be stewardesses together for a minute. And then we decided we were going to be in show business. Because the priest...
Why not?
I know. Well, the priest and, they I told you about, and his choreographer friend, Eugene Loring, who was a big choreographer for Martha Graham and all that stuff. He choreographed Rodeo. That was his... Anyway, he came to do the musicals every year, and he would bring his dancers from Hollywood, from his school here in Hollywood, and they would be the chorus, the dancing chorus, and then we would, be the others. And he spotted that I had something, and he told my parents when they came to see me, he just said, he said that this is a woman who could be a girl or whatever, who could really be something. I'm offering her a scholarship to my studio in California. She will come and she will sing, and I'll have the dancers work around her, and we'll tour the country. And my parents went, "Oy, showbiz, no, no." But they saw that I had talent. So anyway, so off I came to California, and I walked into his office, and he didn't remember me. I know. So, hello. So I looked for a job here, and then my roommate, she got a job, but then she got engaged back in Des Moines. And so together again, my best friend, we went to Milwaukee with my college roommate and who was there. And they all said, go and audition for the theater here. And I went, no.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and they hired me. And then a year later.
What was the show that you auditioned for?
I was in the chorus of Brigadoon.
Oh, my gosh, Brigadoon again.
Well, it's always, listen to my first show. It wasn't my first show at City Center. It was a show at City Center.
Yeah.
I was in the chorus and met some people from New York, and they said, I need a roommate in New York. Do you want to get an apartment? I went, oh, sure, bragging about it. I'm going to go to New York now. And then they wrote to me, and they said, okay, I put the down payment down. You owe me $100. I went, what?
Oh.
So I had to go. But in the meantime, I was learning a lot about musicals and stuff because I was in a review called The Best of... No, it was called Highlights of Musical Theater. It was at a mafia restaurant.
Oh!
And I know it. And so I went with the drummer. The drummer and I drove to New York, and I had my bag of tricks and my audition dress and my audition shoes, audition song.
What was that?
My song was Perfect Relationship from Bells Are Ringing.
Of course.
Because I could make a lot of noise and make a lot of faces and stuff like that. And
how old were you when you moved to New York?
I was old. I was 23.
Huh?
22. I was about to be 23. So I had, killed some time after graduation because I was 21 when I graduated.
And when you moved to New York? Oh, yeah, sorry.
No, go. I was just going to say the little teaching job that I did in California here, near Pasadena, lasted only a few months. And then I went to Milwaukee and got in the theater like almost right away. And then right from there, I went to New York.
And was it hard to figure out the business in New York? I mean, did you get into auditions really quickly? Was it pretty easy?
Oh yeah, the next day. The day after I arrived, I went for an audition for Subways Are for Sleeping, and I got typed out. And I thought, what? I never heard of that. I had my audition dress and everything. And I just started going to auditions, and I can't remember exactly. People liked me, and I didn't have an agent, and I ran into David Hartman. No, was it David Hartman? No, it was somebody else. And I can't remember.
No, it's okay.
And isn't it that term? I can't remember, but he just said, I got to stop at my agent here. I was on my way to audition for Radio City Music Hall for a singer. And so we stopped at his agent's office, and he said, oh, this is my friend Karen, and she sings too. So the agent just said, okay, sing for me. So I went, it's perfect. And he said, just a minute. And he called his wife, and he said, honey, listen to this. And I went, crazy, ridiculous. Did the whole thing, and he said, you know, could I represent you? And I said, sure. And he did that thing. He did that thing. He took me downstairs and took me over to Broadway, and he said, you see that street? I'm going to make that yours.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, way. Yeah, way.
And he did, kind of. I mean, like.
It was so sad. I can't remember his name now, but his assistant took over my life and was, he really did. He put me out there, and I got into a show right away. I got into, I went to one audition, and the accompanist for somebody else heard me. And his show was an off-Broadway show called Sing Muse, and Joanne Worley was the star, and she bowed out. And someone said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? He said, I just heard a girl at an audition, and I don't know how he found me. Geez, because we didn't have cell phones or anything. I don't know how he found me, but he called me and said, he probably called my agent.
Oh, your service number, yeah.
And my agent said, you know, they want you now. So I went down to the Village, auditioned for the guy, and he said, oh, God, you got the job. And he was one of those, too. He said, well, are you going to go back to your apartment? I said, yeah. Yeah. He said, how are you going to get there? I said, Subway. And he gave me $5. He said, here. He said, you're going to be a star. You need to take a taxi.
Wow.
So, well, I mean, with that kind of feedback, I was believing. Well, no, I wasn't really believing. I just went, oh, God, this is New York. Isn't this great?
Right. This is how it always happens.
Yeah. And I had just gotten there. I had just gotten there. So.
And you won a Theater World Award for that.
Yeah, doing Sing Muse. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was Sing Muse about?
It was a was written by Eric Segal, you know, from Loving the Don't Have to Say You're Sorry, from Love Story, and Joe Raposo, who was the original composer on Sesame Street. It was about the Helen of Troy legend, and it was all kind of updated and kind of clever, Achilles was a fighter, a boxer, and we were all kind of contemporary people, and mm-hmm. it was meant to be very, very clever, and it was too clever for its own good.
Mm.
But it was, you know, the Deus Ex Machina came out in a sharp suit and went, you know, there's a guy from Stalag 17, Eddie's. So it was a takeoff on that and gotten very bad reviews, but I got good reviews.
So that was a good introduction for you into New York City. I mean, the industry definitely probably took notice of you just from that alone.
Oh, yeah. I got a lot of telegrams from Richard Rodgers and people like that. And they called my agent and wanted to meet me. And then agents. I still didn't have a big deal agent, and they came along. I mean, they were just all hungry for a new person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the new person there. I was the flavor of the month there for a minute.
Wow.
And so I remember before I went to New York, when I was then interested in music theater in Milwaukee, I would read Variety. I thought it was so cool. And there was always a picture, a caricature of Jimmy Durante in somewhere in the middle of the paper. His caricature with the William Morris logo. You know, where the upside down W and the M is the upside down W, the mm-hmm. W is the upside down M. And so when all these agents came to me, from the big offices, the only one I paid attention to was the Morris office. And also, he was the only agent who came into my dressing room and took off his hat. And I went, wow. The other guy just kind of, I mean, even the biggies came in, and they kept their hand, hi, sweetheart, how are you? And I went, So I signed with Morris, and the next thing I knew, I was Tammy Grimes' standby, went on the road with Molly Brown. So I didn't get a chance to really do anything in New York right after my success, except I went
to the City Center?
No, not yet. I did that when I got back.
Uh-huh.
So I'm talking Molly Brown was in, like, 61.
Oh, okay.
You weren't even born then.
Did you enjoy going on the road?
Oh, yeah. I had never traveled, and I was traveling really well. I got what I thought was a nice salary. It was $900 a week. I was so excited. Geez. No, it was less. But then I took over the role. It was $400. Then I took over the role, and I got $900 a week then. And I thought that was great, and I managed to save it, and you know, had a lot of roommates. We all had lots of roommates, and
yeah.
And when I came back, then you know, then I really started auditioning in earnest,
uh-huh.
And then got on television. I think I did television before I did my first Broadway show.
You did a lot of television.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, well, variety was very important then, and mm-hmm. they were always looking for new faces. Everybody wanted to have the newest, hottest, latest kid. So.
Did you have a favorite television show that you were on a lot?
Let me think. Well, I love being... Yeah, well, I mean, as a guest, I did a thousand zillion Merv Griffin, so that was always fun, and I never knew what he was going to do, and he was so good to me, and he really liked my singing, and he liked playing for me and everything. I love that, but of the series that I did, which none of them lasted long, I loved doing Tabitha because that was just nuts and changing.
Oh, the Bewitched offshoot, yeah.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, it was years after right. Bewitched, but it was playing on the same premise, you know, where Tabitha grew up, you know, the baby was now grown up, and
uh-huh.
and then they needed an Agnes Moorehead type character, so that was me, Aunt Minerva, and
nice.
I know.
Now, Karen, I have to ask you about Merv Griffin. I don't know if you know this, but so many of your episodes are on YouTube.
They are, but they don't show me.
Oh, actually, I was watching a great one yesterday. I wanted to ask you about it. The guests were you, Ethel Merman, Ann Miller, and Dolores Gray.
Yeah, that one. I've seen that 100,000 times. That's been on YouTube a lot. Yeah. Yeah, but I'm talking about the Griffin Show on Get TV. They go way back, and I was on Merv's very first show, and it was in the afternoon. It was probably like 1962 or something. That Milt Kamen and I were the first two guests, and then we traveled with Merv. Merv wanted to take a big band on a bus and go places because he just thought that was great. That was like the old days, mm-hmm. and so he asked me and Milt. We were with the Morris office, but I must say he liked me, which was great, mm-hmm. and I learned a lot. I learned so much about performing and about music and about arrangements and stuff like that, just from doing his show and having people do arrangements and things like that.
Karen, did you have a club act as well?
Not then. I did. Well, the first time I did a club was with Buddy Hackett. Because I was the leading lady in his show, and again, and his friends, you know, I was always opening for. I was doing the benefits with Joey Bishop and all those Borscht Belt comics. Well, they weren't Borscht Belt exactly; they were like the generation after.
Yeah.
But so I was the newest one in the crowd, so I would do that. But then Buddy was asked to do to open a club in a hotel in Cleveland, so he asked me to go along, and I got some arrangements and stuff, and I didn't know how to do an act. I didn't know it all, but I opened the show. Mm-hmm. And then, it was just one night, and then that hotel, by the way, closed down because that was the place where the first Legionnaire's disease
happened. Oh, my gosh.
and so it closed down. Then after that, after I did Joyful Noise with John Raitt, he was doing... a club act. He was doing a lot of club acts, and he asked me to go along with him, and I did one in Chicago, and then I never wanted to do another one again. But I started doing a cabaret act. I started doing a cabaret act in I forgot what year. That would probably be like 74 or 75, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. New York.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SuffsMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And can you take us to I Had a Ball, when that started? Because you must have toured, and then you came back to New York and auditioned earnestly. And you did some City Center stuff then, too, probably.
Yeah.
And then how did I Had a Ball come about?
Audition.
I was
one of those people that was floating around. I auditioned for that and for Kelly. I was out.
Oh, yeah.
I was on the road. That's right. I was on the road with Molly Brown and my agents. While I was out here, they had me do all sorts of auditions, and I got the Red Skelton show, and I don't think there was any other variety show to do. And then while I was on the road, you were always flying, and I was flying into New York to audition for something. So I came in to audition for I Had a Ball and Kelly, the famous One Night Kelly.
Yep.
And one agent at Morris office was representing Kelly, and then my other agents, my most often agents were representing I Had a Ball, and I was offered them both, and I had to make a decision, and something in me said there's been so much press about Kelly, this Kelly, and no one had ever heard of I Had a Ball, and I said I Had a Ball has nowhere to go but up, Kelly has nowhere to go but down.
Wow.
So I decided to do I
Good
Had
choice.
A Ball. If I had done Kelly, you know, who knows what would have happened, but I Had a Ball kept me going with the talk shows and all that stuff for about, as long as it ran, I ran. So that was about 6 months.
Six months, yeah.
I have to ask you, what was it like working with Buddy Hackett?
Oh, well, you don't really, he was just crazy. He was a comic, you know, and then after working with him, I worked with a lot of other comics, and that was a whole other breed. They just, it's about the jokes. He didn't stick to the book.
Yeah, I heard he would, like, break character. I mean, he would, like, do his own shtick sometimes during the show. Like, he would just
do his entire act after the show, and the band would stay. If it hadn't been for him, if it hadn't been for him doing, I mean, an act, he would stick around for half an hour and do, you know, and well, we would all go home. And, but the band stayed until the union finally said, you can't stay, but they were having such a good time.
Oh, my goodness.
But he kept the show running, so we all kept working for 6 months. We would have closed right away because we got seven devastating reviews.
Oh,
there were seven newspapers at that time. Devastating.
Yeah. Karen, what was the plot of I Had a Ball? What was it about?
It was a carnival, Coney Island carnival, folk. Mm-hmm. And he was a phony looking into a ball, crystal ball.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people would come in and he'd tell them things, you know, like there are now.
Still there.
Phony
Still there.
I know. And, but then all the rest of us were just carnival folk, and I forgot what the plot was.
There was, like, a love story with, like, Stan, the Richard Kyle, you know, he's, like, the couples are mismatched, and at the end you kind of end up in the right couples.
Well, I ended up with him, except the scene right before the end of the show was a Tunnel of Love scene.
Yeah.
Where we go to black light. And you've probably read this before. And so I would hop in. I would get in the car with somebody. I don't know. And then the car comes around to the front of the stage again. And there I am with Dick Kiley. And everything is just fine. But night after night, because the car would go backstage. It would go behind the... behind the scrim or behind the curtain, the backdrop, and then we'd come out into the light. So back then we would scramble. I'd get in the front seat or blah, 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 and the guy, you know, Dick would get in the seat next to me, and then we'd come around and the spotlight would hit us. Well, night after night, One night it was Sammy Davis sitting next to me. Another night it was Steve Lawrence sitting next to me. Then there was Dean Martin. I mean, all these friends. Oh, a lot of them were on Broadway at the time, and their shows would come down before us, and then they'd run over and get into the thing.
Have a little cameo.
Yeah, well, you know, the audience would go nuts. They loved it. So we started selling a lot of tickets. We did very well. We did very well based on Buddy and his pals.
Wow.
Yeah.
And there's
the music wasn't bad either. I
just listened to it the other day. I was just going to say, I'm so glad it's preserved on record and that we have you singing the title song and all those other great songs. It's a great score, I think.
I think so. I think it serves its purpose. It's kind of the orchestrators were good guys who had been around. They were real
Phil Lang, I think.
Who?
Wasn't it Phil Lang? Philip Lang?
Philip Lang, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Luther Henderson, I'm trying to think, did he do some things?
He probably did. There used to be a lot of, like, ghost writers. You know, it wouldn't be just one orchestra. It'd be like a couple because it was just so much work. But... oh, man, it's just...
And there's... I think it might be you on the Ed Sullivan Show doing the title number.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. Now, Karen, how did A Joyful Noise come about for you?
I don't know. I auditioned and got it. Maybe I didn't audition. I don't know. But because I was still kind of the new hot kid with the big voice, there was the part of Mary, Texas... was that of a big voice country western blonde, you know, that type of a thing. And I filled the bill. I don't even remember who wrote it.
Our listeners might, I was just going to say that Joyful Noise isn't exactly a household name. I think there's I have the album, I have a record album of it, but it was a country musical-ish, wasn't it?
Very definitely. John Raitt was a Johnny Cash type character.
Yeah.
And it was, well, you know what it was? It was a face in the crowd, that type of a thing. Where he suddenly became popular, and his little wife, who was played by Susan Watson, went by the wayside, and he fell for me because I was one of those big bosomed, except I wasn't. I didn't have a big bosom. I just had a lot of hair. When you see pictures of me on the album and stuff, you go, what? I mean, they couldn't fit the hat on top of my ponytail, but they put it there anyway.
And Michael Bennett
was the choreographer. It was the first thing he had done. And Tommy Toon was in the chorus.
That's right.
Clog dancing. What?
Did you say clog dancing?
Clog dancing. They introduced clog dancing where the dancers all wore clogs and did like they see down in the South.
Did you have to clog dance as well?
Oh, no. I just wore boots and a ponytail and a dumb hat.
That was enough for you.
I guess it was... I don't think I must have worn other costumes. I don't know. But I had the costume designer then design me a dress to wear when I traveled with John. When John Raitt and I did our act together, and it was, oh God, it was just so darling, you want to kill yourself. It was just so, it wasn't like Dolly Parton, but it had a lot of gewgaws and ruffles and stuff like that.
Now, I have to ask you, what was it like working with John Raitt?
Very nice. He's a wonderful man. He was very opinionated. I worked with him many times after that. We did Stock together. Annie Get Your Gun we did together a lot. And he would always do his act after the show. What is it with it? Because I was really the star of Annie Get Your Gun, and he felt he didn't get his just dessert.
Oh, he didn't get his time, yeah.
So, but then he did that with other things, too. So he did. He would do that. But he was very, very nice. We would all gather around his feet, practically, and he would just talk about himself and the old days what guys did and stuff. And he would always say, oh, come on, let's all go. And so the kids in the chorus, we'd go to a restaurant or something, and then he would hold court. And finally, I remember saying to my friend, I said, if I become like John Raitt, I said, just shoot me. I said, it's because... he was interesting, but I thought, I don't want to be one of those people that talks about, you know, that talks about the old days or stuff like that. But he had a lot to talk about. Hell, he was there history-making.
Yeah, he was there.
All those wonderful people that he worked with, and he had things to say about that. And I just thought, oh, I hope I can talk about things other than the past, but here I am talking about the past to you.
Well, that's the point. That's the point of this. We asked you.
Yes, we asked you. You didn't just throw it out
there. We're thankful. We want more and more.
So You know, one of the things that we love to do on the podcast, Karen, is talk about more obscure musicals. And one of the ones that we're fascinated with is this. It's called The Grass Harp. Our listeners love it. A lot of people that we've interviewed previously on the podcast have talked so highly about it. We had Walter Bobby on a few weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
And he spoke so reverentially of it. So I have to ask you, can you share some of your experiences about working on The Grass Harp?
Sure. First of all, what you know was originally done many, many years ago, before it ever got to New York, and Elaine Stritch was doing it. I forgot what theater it was. And then it was just kind of put to bed someplace. Then when they resurrected it, it was with Celeste Holm. And they did it in Ann Arbor at the college there at the University of Michigan. They kind of tried it out there. And they brought in, oh, this is terrible, not Truman Capote. Who did they bring? Oh, come on. The play. Ed Albee.
They brought
in Ed Albee because one of the two writers was a friend of him.
Yeah.
And he came and saw it, and he kind of pointed out where there's problems. But Celeste Holm didn't want, you know, the Big Baby Love number is very, very long on stage. It's very, very long. On the record, it's only 11 minutes. But on stage, the whole sequence was about almost a half an hour. And she didn't like the idea of not being in the first act and then coming on the second act. She didn't want to learn that whole thing either. This is what I heard. This is what they told me. So she quit before they got to Broadway. So this is one of those things where you get to Broadway in a fever. So I had already been doing, you know, lots of television and stuff like that, and doing guest shots and concerts and things. And they, I don't know whose idea it was, but they called me, and I had like 2 weeks. I got an apartment, and I had 2 weeks to learn the show, and we did not go out of town, and we opened, and it just didn't do well at all. And they had a choice. Klabe and Kenward, the composer and lyricist, had a choice of to put some money into keeping it running for another week till we got to the holiday season in hopes that it would pick up, or taking that money and doing a cast recording. And they decided to take the money and do a cast recording because in the long term that would service them better as writers, because there would be evidence of, you know, and there would be a good ticket.
Yeah.
So we closed the show again. Oh, it's just so sad. On Christmas Eve.
Oh.
And, no, wait a minute. No, we closed Joyful Noise on Christmas Eve.
Oh.
That was
in a blizzard.
Ooh. And Tommy Tune and I walked up the street to his friend Rosanna Huffman's apartment. She and Marsha Wallace were sharing an apartment in the Upper West Side. The only way to go was by walking.
Oh,
and it was one of those things where all we needed was a little match girl outside the stage door if they were unloading everything. They're unloading all the stuff. And I remember Bonnie Raitt was only about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old or something. And she thought it was just so sad.
Oh, yeah.
But no. But Joyful Noise, or Grass Harp, closed, and we were all called to go and rehearse our songs that were going to be put on the record with Jonathan Tunick.
Oh.
John was going to go and conduct in Germany. They decided to do it in Germany because they could get a huge orchestra from all over the continent. That's what they do. They hear that there's a Broadway show or something doing a recording, and then they all want to work. Pardon me. So anyway, I went over to Klabe's apartment and rehearsed my numbers, you know, the tempos and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I said, you know, I've never been to Europe. Can I go with you?
Yes.
And they said, sure. Come
on. Gosh.
So I just went and watched them do the recording sessions. Then we would go out with the musicians and everything. And I said, I really would like to, you know, go and see Europe. And they said, why don't you put your stuff down here in Germany? And then you can go on, you know, go to Paris or wherever you want to go. And I said, really? Because they were then going to take all the tracks back to New York, and everybody was going to put their stuff on. And I don't think, if what I can remember, is that no two people were in the same recording studio at the same time. So anytime you hear a chorus or something like that, it's, I guess, everybody recorded their own parts.
And they just mixed it.
And the engineer. I think it was one of the most brilliantly engineered musicals. Unfortunately, somebody took it and recently remixed it and is selling it. Pardon me. And I listened to both of them side by side, and the new mix is not good because...
Oh, wow.
Well, the singers are part of the orchestra, and I just said, no. The singer always has to be in front. You always have to know that the singer is in front, mm-hmm. and the orchestra, not way in the background, but takes secondary position,
yeah.
more or less, except when they have their moments to shine. But it's just that little nano difference. So if anybody wants to get that CD, it behooves them to get the original CD. But anyway.
That's what I'll do.
That's a great recommendation. But I hope you know how treasured it is mm-hmm. among so many musical theater fans.
Yeah, people talk about that. And I know people have said that they clean their house listening to the Baby Love Miracle show. And I laugh because it just has a lot of energy. But I always use that. A combination of that and, share my joy and love, all my mm-hmm. joy and love. Going into the greenest, grandest, greatest state of them all, I go right into the end of I Had a Ball,
yeah.
my opening. So, but the thing is that, 20 years, 30 years after that, people go, what is that song? What is that opening? But, yeah, it was... It was an odd experience doing that because Ellis Rabb, our director, was so wonderful. He was just a doll, a dreamboat, fun. He reminded me of Charles Nelson Reilly, a little bit more erudite Charles. And I remember the night before, about a week before opening, I said, I just want you to know that I will have a nervous breakdown somewhere before opening. I said, I'll be so scared and so upset and everything, I'll just break down. So sure enough, about 2 days before opening, I just sat down in the middle of the stage and just cried and cried and cried and cried. And I hear from the back of the house, is this it, Miss Morrow? Yes, it is. I said, okay, I'll get over it. But the next thing I remember that he said when I was doing a scene, I had to come in and go, ABGB trouble or whatever I had to do when I made my entrance. He said, stop. He said, I would like it to be more blah, 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 blah. And I just said, oh, help me, help me, help me. Give me an image. And he said, think Halloween. And I went, got it. Got it. Okay.
Wow.
But still, I never was the actress that I should have been. I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to break down scenes. I didn't know how to work slowly. I remember first day of the read-through in I Had a Ball, and we were all sitting around the table, and I did this full-blown performance, as did Buddy. And we got around to Dick reading his lines, and he was just kind of, and I thought, why on earth did they get him to play a lead in a musical? Well, you can't even hear him. He's not enunciating. Oh, my, oh, my. Well, I didn't realize that you're supposed to work on it slowly. I was the finished product the first day of rehearsal.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to do that. I did not know how to do that. To take the time of 7 weeks or whatever it was. And the same thing with Grass. Of course, I didn't have that time with the Grass Harp, but
right.
I just didn't know enough. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I didn't continue. I didn't get really great parts and have a good Broadway career. I could have had, if I had been more of a student of the art instead of just a singer that worked a lot. I mean, I kept getting hired for being who I was.
And you had some, there's an element of, I don't want to say luck, but, some shows are, you get in a good show and sometimes you don't. And I think there's, you also had some kind of crappy luck as well. I mean.
No, but who gets in crappy shows? I mean, the really extraordinary people get in extraordinary shows. And that doesn't necessarily, I was thinking like Linda Lavin, who was a cohort of mine. And my friend Nancy Dussault.
Nancy Dussault, yeah.
I mean, they were more interesting as actors. They were braver as actors. Now, Linda didn't have the voice that Nancy did or that I did, but she was an actress, and she knew how to use it, and so consequently, she did wonderful things. And I'm trying to think of who else. Even little Anita Gillette,
Oh, yeah.
Who now has turned into a wonderful actress. I mean, she was good then, but she really explored her acting. And, of course, I just finished Streisand's, she didn't write it, Hello, Gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
Have you read it?
No, how is it?
Well, I want to slip my wrists after I read it, because she was our contemporary.
Yeah.
And a few years younger. And she was, to read how she did her, how she used her ambition was just mind-boggling, because I wasn't aware of any of that. None of it. I don't know. Nancy said that she was aware that Barbara was kind of a big deal. But I thought, why didn't we have that kind of ambition? Yeah. What the heck was she doing? Well, she wasn't making friends, I know that, whereas we were. But I just thought, that's what it took, you know, that's what it took.
Now, in addition to your amazing career, you are one of the most, yes, this is an amazing career. You are so well-loved and so well-respected. And I cannot tell you.
Need to hear that at this stage, may I tell you? Yeah. That's nice.
I mean, I cannot tell you the number of students who praise your voice.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, because, you know. Go ahead.
Because, sorry.
Say it again?
No, I just said go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt you.
It is such a fantastic instrument that so many students will listen to it and go, I want to do that, I want to do that. And that really is you. So you might not feel like, you might feel it sometimes, but trust me, it's there. And so what I wanted to talk to you about, though, was you also are incredibly well-respected as a teacher and as an educator out in Los Angeles.
I just love it.
How did you transition to teaching?
Well, by the way, I just want to go back and comment about what you said about the voice. See, I didn't know I had that voice until recently. Probably about 5 or 6 years ago, my friend Mark Sendroff would make me sit down and listen to things that he had recorded. And I was distant enough that I sat and I listened to some of these, and I went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Well, we all kind of had those voices going up and down. That, you know what I mean? Nancy could do that too. Pam Myers. But I didn't know that was something that was unusual. And now I listen, I go, geez, Karen, you dodo. Why didn't you know that? Why couldn't you have done something? So I'm grateful that I just discovered that. So now, what did you say?
I had asked, how did you transition into teaching?
Bit by bit, when I was doing the TV show Friends, was it Friends? A.J. Carruthers, who was the producer and writer of that, had a son at UCLA who was in the Carol Burnett. He was going to do the Carol Burnett competition, and which they did every year. Carol would give money for an award and stuff. And he just said, the kid was educated nicely. I mean, he wanted to do Sondheim for his audition piece. And so his dad asked me if I would coach him. And I said, coach him? What? No. He said, no. He said, I'm a fan, you know, of your voice, and you know how to sing, and you know all that stuff. So would you coach him? I said, okay. So I started working with him, and I realized that since I was on the outside of it, and I wasn't singing it, I could hear and listen to where things needed to happen, where he needed to change his sound, where he needed to have a new thought, where he needed to, how to connect with me. And so I helped him through that. And his dad also, did his bit in it. And the kid won. He won the competition, and I was shocked. Christopher Carruthers. And I went, oh my. So then the word kind of spread, and the teacher over... Then I decided to do a class of my own, and I put an ad in Backstage West or something, and I got enough people to sign up, Christopher being one of them, Christopher Carruthers, and there were some people that were okay, and I kind of liked it. I like talking about things like that, and then I stopped. Then that was the end of that. Then, honey, I can't begin to tell you, then later on, 25 years ago, I just, people kept asking me, would you help me, would you help me, would you help me, would you coach me, would you coach me? So I just said, why don't I start a class again? And so I did. I started what I call my grown-up class. And that was, we would do one session on a Monday night, and that went on for years and years and years and years and years. And then all of a sudden it got bigger. So I split it into two, a Saturday afternoon class plus a Monday night class. And that's where I am today. And it's all word of mouth. I never advertised again, but
wow,
it's all word of mouth. Yeah. So I've learned a lot over the years. I think I'm a better teacher now than I was back when I first started. But it comes from being on the outside and looking in. But having, I know what it feels like to just keep singing and hope that the voice is good enough. I now know that, no. I know how to be brave, and that's what I can ask of anybody, is to be brave. And the same thing now when I teach high school kids, it's the same thing. It's a little bit more codified for them, you know, don't move your arms so much, you know, stuff like that. But I grew into it, and it was very rewarding. And I don't charge a lot. I mean, I never made hardly any money doing it. The only place that really pays me well is like when I go out to do conferences and stuff like that, you know, and University of Nebraska or other universities. And then downtown here, I do the semifinalists for the Spotlight Awards, which is a very big competition, county-wise and all of that, that the Music Center Philharmonic sponsors. And that's quite rewarding because it's usually the best kids from, best teenagers from around. So that's a challenge. But
Karen, what performers today do you respect and admire? Do you think bring that to the stage when you watch them?
Well, I haven't seen much lately. I definitely think that Kelly O'Hara is a talent. I saw Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
Oh yeah.
Here, but it was with the Broadway understudy, and he was so good. And this is awful. I can't think of his name. Is it Kevin Hershey, something like that. I admired his taste and his, because he was different than the guy in New York, from what I understand. But he chose his own path, and I thought he was wonderful. Not the one who plays the 100,000 parts, but the
younger guy,
yeah.
The other guy, yeah. Just so consistent. So, but now let's see. I respect. I just haven't seen anybody I've seen that's been out here. I think who's doing great? I think that Betty Buckley is just quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
She's nuts, but she's extraordinary. Who's playing with her in Grey Gardens?
Rachel York.
I think Rachel has done really well doing all sorts of things. I think she's terrific. And men, Stokes has grown on me. Mm. He's grown on me. Let me see. Who else? Oh, well, Victoria Clark just knocked me out when I saw
her. She's amazing.
Oh, Light in the Piazza. She was really good in Follies out here with Ron Raines, but not quite vulnerable enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was just almost too good.
Yeah.
I mean, her voice is so beautifully rounded and so wonderfully, exquisitely trained. And I hear she's a good teacher.
Yes, she is a great teacher, actually. You're right.
Love her. And who else? I don't know. Name some people for me. Name some people that are current.
I was going to say, there's Audra McDonald.
I admire her career. From the very beginning, when she was not Audra and somebody was auditioning her to do a recording for them, I thought her voice was not mellow and not nice, and I didn't want to listen to her on the recording, but they got her anyway, and now she's Audra McDonald. So who am I? What do I know about anything? I admire her so. You know, Bernadette and Patti LuPone, all those people, they just have worked their tushies off, and they stayed who they are, and I admire that. Tendency to say, oh, I never really quite did as well as Babs Streisand.
Yeah.
And we're all going through that. What didn't I do? We sit and we talk about it. You know, I didn't become this. I didn't do that. And everybody's got those right now, we're going, everybody's going through that, and we have to be reminded. We just have to be reminded of what there is and what is left and behind for people.
And the legacy that you created, because you did create a legacy, Karen, in that, and if we're the ones to help remind you today, then I am certainly happy to be on that boat.
it's just so wonderful. I know it. I'm delighted. I'm absolutely thrilled and delighted, and I probably will go and fix myself a hot fire sundae now. I have to give myself permission to eat something really outrageous, and I thought, well, this has been so good. That won't put any calories on me today because I'm wonderful.
Oh, my gosh.
I love that. That's so wonderful. Yeah. I hope we get to see you on stage again quite soon as well.
Well, I don't know where, but okay.
anything. We love watching you. We love seeing you on stage.
Well, thank you. I think probably I was in thinking about this. I know my friend Nancy's going to go to New York and do a night at 54 Below, and she still has, you know, her ambition there, and I just thought, Karen, just keep singing. Just keep singing. Keep the voice up, because I have been singing at you know, these conferences and stuff like that. I did one with the guys who wrote Elf, and I did music from Elf at the University of Nebraska, and then I just did something with Steve Lutvak of his and stuff like that, and I thought, and I'm always amazed because I don't give myself enough time to get the voice going, and I thought, Karen, you've just got to vocalize every week to keep it up.
Do it.
Anyway, I will.
Please do it.
Karen, I hate to talk business over the phone, but I'm a producer at 54 Below, where Nancy's going to be. Please let me know if you ever want to come do a cabaret. I know it would sell tickets.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to plant that seed in your head, and you can do with it what you want, but trust me, people would love to see you in New York and would absolutely come out for an evening of your work.
Definitely.
Wow, that's really something. Thank you. I would probably have to go right to the hospital from there. I said, well, one of the reasons why I don't keep doing an act, first of all, I don't like working at night. Secondly, of course, Nancy, she said, oh, she's delighted because she's working at 7 o'clock. She says, isn't that great? I went, oh, that's fabulous. But it's just that the kind of singing that I did, the kind of singing that people liked and expect of me, is big and fun, and it was a balance thrown in every once in a while, and I thought, that takes so much more energy than planning an evening of lovely songs, you know? It's just so much. I mean, Nancy's act is just lovely, and she does a lot of lovely, lovely, lovely material, but she does those so well, and plus she does a couple of, you know, funny things and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I would have to do just the opposite. I'd have to do more funny, more kind of up things, and then fewer ballads. But
it'd be worth it.
Karen, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you both so much. Good luck, and I look forward to hearing from you.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.